Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to try to work through our agenda in order here today. So we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 157 and does have an amendment here. Dr. Warner.
Good morning, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. The Senate Bill 157 is a bill that was introduced in pre-session file. This really was directed at the possibility that the corporate minimum tax may increase significantly. What the bill does is it requires 2% of the revenue received from the corporate minimum tax be deposited in the statutory rainy day fund, the first deposit being 1719. Currently, the corporate minimum taxes are the latest full corporate tax year we have are $42 billion. So this was anticipating the possibility that could be higher. But what I thought I would do with the committee is take the opportunity to kind of run through where we are in terms of the reserve funds. We had a task force in the interim created by Senate Bill 800. The chair and vice chair were both on that task force. And it had consisted of Ways and Means and Revenue Committee members. So just we do have some final results in from the Pew Center who assisted the task force, and I'll walk through some of that, go through a little bit of history with you, and then walk through some of those results. The reserve funds that we're looking at are the two reserve funds are the Constitutional Education Stability Fund, created in 2002 in special session, actually the second try with the voters. In 2007 was the rainy day fund that was created statutorily, but was actually, there was a large corporate kicker projected at that time, kicker credit, and that was diverted with a two-thirds vote into creating the statutory rainy day fund. The current Education Stability Fund receives about 18%. Receives 18% of lottery earnings, so it's a steady flow of revenue into the fund. And the Oregon Rainy Day Fund has really its primary source of revenue is 1% of the ending balance. That calculation is made following the end of a biennium. So, for example, in January of 2018. We'll have all of the reversions in for the general fund from this biennium, and then the calculation will be done at 1%. That's a little over $150 million that will be going into the reserve fund in January of 2018. It also receives a portion of corporate income tax collections that go into the fund. Those are estimated and deposited into the fund at the end of the biennium. The methods of withdrawal are the same. The only difference is that there is an emergency provision in the Education Stability Fund. The governor can declare emergency, but the key for any of these triggers is a three-fifths vote. So three-fifths vote has to take place no matter what. And you can see what the size is, 5% on the Stability Fund, and then 7.5% on the Rainy Day Fund. This is where we are in terms of our reserve fund position as of your latest forecast. You can see where we are in terms of the beginning balance in the two funds. Total $391 million. Deposits are projected through the biennium to be $374 million. The interest for the Education Stability Fund is used for scholarships. It's not returned to the fund. So, and that goes back to the previous use of the Education Stability Fund. It was originally created as an endowment fund. So that interest withdrawal takes place each biennium and does not go into the balance for the rainy day fund. You can see the projected ending balance for this biennium. The $204 million I put in there is the recommended ending balance for 1719 in the co-chair's framework budget. That's the $204 million there. And so you add those three up, you're at $975 million in terms of the reserves, because you have the Education Stability Fund, the Rainy Day Fund, and once you get into the next biennium, you can appropriate out of that fund anything that's projected to come in during the biennium. And then you also have, of course, as your primary contingency is the projected ending balance, which, of course, tends to go away automatically in a recession. Now, if you combine those, you've got 4.8% of the co-chair's framework budget, so roughly 5%. And there's your projected general fund revenue. You can see that it's projected to fall slightly below trend, but we've seen historically, we know that these ups and downs tend to be more sharp than what's forecast. So we're hovering around the trend with the possibility of dropping below it, and of course, if we go into recession, we would drop significantly below that. There's a history of the reserve fund. I just went back to 2001 when we first began the our reserve fund policies, actually 2002. You can see that our triggers, we have an employment trigger, which is two consecutive quarters of declining employment, or revenue trigger, which is more than 2% below the estimate. You can see our triggers throughout the 2001-03 biennium were in place, meaning that they would have triggered. You go into the, notice that the revenue trigger carried on all the way into 2004, 2005 first quarter, because it's 2% below the close of session. And in that particular recession, we dropped below the close of session and the first quarterly forecast following the close of session and stayed there for the whole biennium. You can see we moved away from the triggers, and then, of course, with the Great Recession in 2008 and then on through 2009, the triggers were in place. The revenue trigger carrying on into 2011 and into to the 2012 calendar year. So we basically had two biennia which the triggers were in place in that period. These are the allocations out of the reserve fund. You can see that in 2001-03, of course, the rainy day fund didn't exist at that time. There was $262 million was allocated out of the Education Stability Fund, $140 in the 2003-05 biennium. And then when both funds were available in 2009-11, you can see that the RDF at 351 allocation, 84 of the reserve fund, the Education Stability Fund. And if you look at the old 2009-11 period, it covered about 41% of the shortfall. And then if you look at kind of the total history over the period of the reserve funds, this is what I used for the shortfall is comparing the actual with the close of session. You can see reserve fund allocations are about $1.4 billion, which were about a third of what the projected shortfall was. So those are the kind of things you want to think about in terms of reserve funds. What's your target in terms of what you want to be able to cover? And what the Pew Center did was go through and look, made estimates on how the reserve fund balances you have would respond to different scenarios. So this is part of their presentation for the task force and their final report. You can see the questions they tried to address. Do the funds reflect the volatility of the state? Are the current levels limits on deposits appropriate? And so you compare those with those scenarios. Are the sources of deposits adequate? And then the rules for getting funds out for expenditures, are those adequate? No surprise here, Oregon's economy is more volatile than the nation. You can see that we swing up and down. We tend to follow the national cycle, but we have stronger expansions and deeper recessions. So this is irrespective of our revenue system. Our economic volatility indicates that reserve fund policies relatively important in Oregon.
Senator Buckley.
Mr. Chair. I actually have observed something suddenly. I don't think your Swiss Alps analogy is right. This is more like Norway. You see there's fjords over there that go really deep during the recession. So I think we should switch to Norway and Sweden rather than the Swiss Alps for your mountain goat. And the clouds are coming, Paul. Mark
yes,
my word.
Yes, the clouds are coming, yes. But, Mr. Vice Chair, this is the economy. So the economy may be the fjords, but then the revenue tends to be more the Alps. Because you have those two sources of volatility. You have one is the economy itself, and the second piece is how does your revenue respond to it. And in both of those areas, we have greater volatility. Our economy is more volatile because of the importance of manufacturing and the capital spending cycle. And then our revenue, of course, because of the composition of our taxes, is more volatile. So then Pew went through and looked at where the balances are relative to These are the total amount. These are the two caps added together. You can see prior to 2008, you just had the Ed Stability Fund, and then when you added in the Rainy Day Fund, you're up to 12.5%. But, of course, you can set any cap you want. The important thing is being able to fill up to the cap and how quickly it fills up. So one issue, though, to look at, are the caps adequate? Do they need to be adjusted? And the other issue are how quickly are we filling up to these caps? And you can see that if you look out through 2017, the numbers I had took that through 17-19. So you can see right about 4%, and as we saw 17-19, we're up to about 4.8% of general fund. So here's the two scenarios that Pew looked at. They looked at an average recession in which they fall below the normal for the trend by the typical amount for a recession, and then they showed a more severe recession based something on along the lines of the 07-09 period, where it takes 5 years to return to normal growth, but you fall way below. And here's their they tend to look at things on an annual basis, and you can see our revenue stream where our volatile sources are. Of course, corporate is by far the most volatile, but the personal income tax you can see in 04 and again in 11 dropped significantly. So their conclusion is that if your target is to meet an average recession, you need about a 4% balance. You need to try to get to 4% of general fund fairly quickly, and we are at that level now. So if your policy is to prepare for this average recession, you're pretty much there in the current environment. If, however, your policy is to deal with something like along the 09-11 period, a more severe recession, then you're quite a ways from it. That's a 10% is their estimated need for a reserve fund. So you're less than half that.
Senator Boquist.
So when we're dealing with the percentages in the calculations here, are we talking about general fund only?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes. These are calculated as a percentage of general fund.
Follow up. In your opinion, given the fact that the budget's over $72 billion this year, the next biennium, and the general fund's only around 20, which is less than, you know, a third of the budget, I mean, are these numbers, they really don't cover it because you still have all of the rest of your other funds, rest of your federal funds, which all disappear. Mm-hmm. As you recall, in 09-11, we took a $5 billion cut, literally a $5 billion cut. Mm-hmm. And so even though we say 4% or 5% is adequate, it's adequate to cover only the portion of the general fund, it appears to be.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Mr. Vice Chair. A couple things, though. Of course, the general fund's what you're constitutionally obligated to balance for a two-year period. So that becomes the immediate urgent need. And the other fund components, certainly the volatility creates a lot of problems for you in terms of policy. And the biggest one is, one of the largest components of the other fund revenue is what's called interest earnings, but it's really PERS earnings. And that can swing anywhere from a plus $15 billion to a negative number. So that's where you've seen the greatest, you know, on a pure revenue basis. And that's where you see the greatest volatility in the other fund revenue sources. And, of course, that creates a lot of problems for you down the road. As you've seen, you're still living with some of the consequences of the Great Recession and its impact on those earnings. So, yeah, that's very much something that needs to be part of the planning process. Now, the federal funds, which are your federal funds are as large in total as your total taxes. So, but they, of course, follow a different pattern. Sometimes they increase in the recession like they did in 07-09 when the federal government's trying to stimulate the economy. Other times they decrease for reasons unrelated to the economy. So they're moving in different ratios. But, yeah, those things are important. But in terms of the immediate requirement to balance your budget, I think this is a reasonable thing to look at least initially. And then this is looking at the recommendation that Pew has consistently made and made again on this report is you need to look at those periods where you're above the trend and find mechanisms that pull revenue out and put it in reserve fund in some automatic way. And that's their number one recommendation, is that you take these above-trend revenue sources and design a mechanism that saves when they're above trend, particularly the volatile revenue sources. And that's something, if you look at our where we have our contributions to the reserve fund, the lottery is not particularly volatile. It's subject to a lot of market conditions, but not necessarily the economy as much. But there are volatile components, with the exception of the corporate income tax, where you do put some aside. We don't have a large amount going into reserve funds.
Getting into a sore subject here.
Yes. Another recommendation was to look at the trigger level. They expressed a lot of concern about looking forward to 17-19, particularly from kind of the ways and means perspective, that you've got a structural deficit out there, and are there times when maybe you could should allocate revenue for triggers that maybe respond to things other than the kind of traditional economic responses that we have in there now.
Like what kind of different?
Well, you have in the Education Stability Fund, you have the governor's declaration of emergency, but there may also be some things that could be on the fiscal side that trigger use of the funds. So that could be something that impacts general fund expenditures, current service expenditures, in some dramatic way. And then their current level of reserves are adequate, but they're adequate only in the sense that you're preparing for an average or typical recession. If you're for a severe one, they're not. They're only about, they're half. And then, of course, as we talked about a lot last session, we know where the volatile revenue sources are. They're the corporate income tax, which we have a great difficulty in projecting, and the capital and personal income tax revenue from capital gains, which is extremely volatile, and we would expect that to continue into the future.
Senator Riley?
Paul, could you go back to the previous slide and where it's, you said the current, you didn't say the current maximum levels are adequate, which I think it says there. Mm-hmm. They're not saying that what we have now is in reserves is adequate. They're saying the maximum levels.
Yes, that's correct. So okay. You're right. You're right. Mm-hmm. Because, right. That's the 12%, 12.5%. So those are adequate, yes. So, and then that's my last slide, Mr. Chair. And we'll see. You can see the pattern with the capital gains where we've gone up and down and relatively flat for the 15-17 biennium. And we'll see what 17-19 looks like.
Okay, I have a couple quick questions. One on the earnings on the school stability fund. You said going to scholarships.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
The opportunity grant?
Yes.
Is that what you meant? Okay.
Yes. And that goes back to the very beginning of the Education Stability Fund, because those dollars, it was initially set up as a trust fund for education to fund education improvements. And those interest earnings were flowing into scholarships, and that wasn't changed when the fund itself.
About what's the ballpark amount of?
Well, you can see the interest earnings for 15-17 were $5.2 million.
Okay.
And then those were netted out. They were all withdrawn and allocated. They're basically appropriated.
All right. On the rainy day fund, we have a portion of the corporate income tax collections going to the rainy day fund, which was sort of the 66 and 67.
Yes.
If we go this other route, how can we convert that mechanism into a change to a commercial activity tax?
Mr. Chair, there's you'd have a number of ways of you can do that. We took kind of a wild stab at it in SGR 41 that just as a first look at, kind of mimicking the kicker, where if you're over 2% of the close of session projection on the corporate activities tax, then that would go into the reserve fund, the amount above 2%. But
you said you took a wild stab at it in one of the drafts, or you
mean? Yes, in the SGR 41 that you have.
Yeah,
so, but that would be. That was obviously just to put a placeholder there for some type of reserve allocation. You could do a percentage You could make a trend calculation. That's, I think, basically what Pew would recommend. You figure what the trend is in that revenue source, and then when you go above it, you have a mechanism that puts a portion in the reserve fund.
Okay. Well, I'm reminded, especially in that last slide here, that the corporate tax, the corporate income tax that we currently have is not only narrowing, but it's extremely volatile.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and it's trying to forecast that is, believe me, a humbling experience.
Senator Boquist?
I have two questions, and I'm not trying to be contrary. I'm just trying to understand. Paul, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how comfortable you are with, you know, the Pew's analysis. I mean, Pew is the same entity in which you've seen the report that says if there's a federal tax cut, we'll get somewhere between 16 and 46% revenue increase in the state of Oregon, and your staff says no, it's almost revenue neutral. So they're producing or proposing happy days are here again under their analysis for taxes. And are you comfortable with their work here? Since you disagree on the other side, I'm just wondering how comfortable you are with Pew's analysis here.
Mr. Vice Chair, yeah, I think on the as far as the federal tax reform plans, I mean, that's still very much up in the air. So, I mean, it's hard to, we interpreted what we saw about the interest, the deductions on investment income. I mean, that's the way it was portrayed in the proposal would clearly affect us, and I don't think they accounted for that. In terms of the recommendation, we, of course, have been very supportive of the idea of finding a way to set aside the volatile revenue sources. That makes a lot of sense, and there's above trend revenue, and finding a way to do that, at least for policymakers to be aware of it and make those adjustments. In terms of this being adequate, I personally think we are in a period where we're going to have more severe cycles. And what we consider the normal or average cycle, I think, will change over the next couple decades. And I think the experience we had over the last 15 years and the last two recessions in terms of revenue, I think, are more reflective of what we'll see going forward. So I would be hesitant to anticipate that these normal mild cycles are going to be the pattern. I think we're going to see more severe ones. And I think that's a policy decision to make sure that you think about that and try to prepare for them.
Senator Boquist?
Just one follow-up. We've made it several statements in here, and once again, you referred to the Oregon's responsibility to constitutionally balance the budget, and I'm just formally going to challenge that. That's a myth created by legislative counsel, and they've taken a 180-degree position in writing this session. And so, I mean, it's a combination of two separate portions of the Constitution. And their new position is that if the executive branch spends money, then we have to raise taxes to balance the budget at the end of the session. So I'm not sure there is a constitutional requirement to balance the budget as of now. So I just want that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Well, there is we're prohibited from deficit spending.
But Mr. Chair, I'm going to correct you on that. There's a legal opinion out there that says if the executive branch deficit spends, that we are required to vote for a tax increase, the five of us, and that they can do it, and they have done so in the past, and we're required, which is a 180-degree opinion from every other session that any of us have been in, even before you were here, Madam Senator, and Senator Burchard. We've always gone on that assumption, Mr. Chair, but there is now a legal opinion out there that says if the executive branch goes and spends money that we didn't allocate, that we're required to raise taxes at the end of the biennium to cover for that expense. That's a new position on the part of legislative council, which I think throws a whole lot of things into question.
So, well, what if that doesn't happen?
Well, then we should have a reserve fund, but there is a senator who killed our bill on the floor when it came back from the Senate, which is that bad portion that you were talking about.
Senator Borchert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I know you and I in our discussions, I think you probably figured out that I'm kind of a demographic nut. And I do believe that the baby boomers' maximum spending age has gone. It's passed on. And that the next group, the millennials, is yet to come. Are you looking at some of that when you're doing your forecasts?
Yes, Senator, that is definitely a factor in the long run. I think, you know, the primary way we look at it is in terms of the kind of the growth rate potential for the economy. And that's the growth rate potential is determined by growth of the labor force and productivity. So the growth of the labor force is slowing. And we know that from the demographics. I mean, that's unless there's some dramatic change in immigration policy where we seem to be going the other direction, then that's very much in the cards. We're going to see a slower growing labor force. So that theoretically could be offset by big gains in productivity. But in the last 10 years, we have not seen that. We've seen productivity actually growing more slowly. So I think we're in for a more slowly growing period. And, of course, we've looked at this. I know the state economist has looked at this. In terms of the revenue stream, we know there's going to be some specific impacts on the revenue stream because of the aging, population. One of the big ones is that Social Security is 100% excluded from Oregon's personal income tax. So unlike the federal government that picks up a share of that Social Security income, the state won't. So that will be a major factor. You did modify the senior medical deduction, and that was another area where we saw a lot of growth and major revenue impacts, but that's been significantly cut back. But the bottom line is I think you're going to see slower growth over time, and you're also going to see the share of that revenue going to the state through the income tax will be shrinking because of the nature of the income that seniors receive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Paul, what about 157? Did you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, we just the idea behind Senate Bill 157 was if we did see passage of Measure 97 or something like it that would increase the corporate minimum, this would be one of the ways to address your earlier question of taking a portion of it and putting it into the rainy day fund. Now, you know, with $42 million, you're looking about at 2% as the bill has, it's roughly $1 million a year, so it's not a significant amount.
Right.
The corporate minimum itself, the way it is set up now, is a relatively stable revenue source because it's based on sales and a flat amount plus sales. So it's a relatively stable, much more stable than the rest of the corporate income tax. It's based on rates and net income.
Could you do a quick number crunch in your head to say if we pass the commercial activity tax under the current sort of scenarios we're looking at, what that number would be? Be higher than $1 million a year?
Well, if you were to look at, say, for example, a net of $1 billion a year in a corporate activity tax, then you'd have this would be 2% would be putting aside about $20 million a year, so it's $40 million a biennium.
Yeah,
which would be a significant addition to your reserves.
That's up, Senator Riley.
So just to follow up on what Senator Volquist was saying, if you read the Constitution, Article 9, Section 2. It says exactly what LC is now telling us and what I've always thought the Constitution said, which is we are required to raise revenue for whatever the expenditures are. Article 9, Section 2.
Through a vote. And if the votes aren't there.
Doesn't say anything about a vote.
Order.
just like education fund is in the state of Washington, which is what they cite.
Mm-hmm.
This is we're in contempt, but that's all right.
That's
we
right.
Leave the country at $10,000 a day. We'll be okay.
That's right.
All right.
Okay.
Paul, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157. And I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 28. Kyle?
Chris.
I'm
sorry.
Chris.
I was thinking, boy, really going
that way. Well, Kyle got up and gave me a head fake.
Yeah.
Faked me out, too.
Yeah. I thought he misheard. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 28, there is a dash 6, the original bill. The dash 6 replaces the bill. And what it does is it replaces the cost of performance method of apportionment with the market-based apportionment. You do have the paperwork, however, I think there need to be some additional amendments pertaining to financial institutions. We just got word of that this morning. We just got word this morning that there might need to be some amendments for financial institutions. I think we just got the fiscal, it was a minimum. The revenue impact that I put together for the Dash 6 is an indeterminate, and that's largely because the change in cost of performance to market would have winners and losers, so to speak. Some corporations would likely face a tax increase, and others would likely face a tax decrease. And as I've looked at other states that have gone to this, I've tried to find some way to hinge an actual number for the revenue impact. Over the past 10 or 15 years, a number of states have moved to market-based performance, market-based apportionment, and I can't find any information yet to indicate even what their actual experience was, even after they had moved from cost of performance to market-based.
Chris, could you do this? Could you take two steps back, give us the overview? We're still talking about a corporate income tax world here, and how would this change it? Maybe throw in a hypothetical.
So for right now, for corporations that operate in multiple states, what we're talking about is apportioning their income to Oregon. You have a corporation that operates in multiple states, and because of our tie to federal taxable income, the starting point is their U.S. taxable income, and then the question is, what piece of that does Oregon get to tax for corporations that have nexus in Oregon? Within that world, there are two pots, if you will. There's the tangible personal property, and then there are the intangible slash services. For tangible personal property, the apportionment is kind of intuitive in that it's market-based. If a company sells their products, their chairs, their desks, their computers into Oregon, tangible personal property, then the share of the federal income that Oregon gets to tax is their single sales apportionment, the share of U.S. sales that are made in Oregon. Be that 0.5%, 1%, or 10%. For intangibles and services, it's done differently. We still have a single sales factor, but since it's fundamentally different kind of property, the apportionment is done on a cost of performance. And this is where if a corporation is operating in, say, three states, Oregon, California, and Idaho, the market for their sales isn't what determines how much we get to tax. It's cost of performance, so it depends on where that service is produced. And so if, for example, I'm going to stick with a corporation that operates in those three states, if 60% of their cost of producing their service is done in Oregon and 20% in California and 20% in Idaho, Oregon gets all of those sales, because it's an all or nothing. We have the plurality. 60% of their cost of performance is in Oregon, so all of their sales come to Oregon. If we switch that up a little bit so that Oregon has 30% and California has 60% and Idaho has 10%, then Oregon gets nothing, because it would all go to California. And so in those two cases, in either case, switching from cost of performance to market base, Oregon would get something. So in the case where, in one case, Oregon is going from everything to something, so that's a revenue loss for the state, versus Oregon is going from nothing to something, which is a revenue gain to the state. So conceptually, that's the trade-off in terms of coming up with an actual dollar number for the revenue impact. And because of the information that we have available, we can't look at the Oregon returns and figure that out. It's not something that's endemic or endogenous to the tax return itself, or we can model it, say, for a tax credit. If a tax credit is reported on the tax return, we can take that information and have it and model it with and without that. Same thing with taxable income, but with the apportionment, we just have the Oregon sales. And I'm simplifying exactly how this is done, because it gets a lot more technical and a lot more complicated. So we just can't look at that sales and figure out what it would be under an alternate scenario. So that's kind of a dead end at this point. And then looking to other states, it's, well, we've had a number of states that have gone to from cost of performance to market-based. So I've tried to look in those states to find out what their actual experience was. And I find a lot of qualitative information and talking about it, but no numbers that I could even say, well, California experienced this and Wisconsin experienced that. And so given Oregon's structure and how we're similar to those other states.
So there's no kind of best practice or this is the road you want to go down?
No, I think it comes back to it's not a revenue impact driven, it's more of a theory driven, policy driven. In that, so as states move to a single sales factor, the underlying idea is that corporate income taxation should be on the benefit to a given company for access to a state's economy, basically its customers and its market. So a market-based sourcing is more in line.
Consistent.
It's more consistent with that concept. So I think, as far as I can tell, that's why states are moving in that direction. It kind of goes hand in hand with the single sales.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So Chris, I always notice that, you know, you guys look at it from a state's perspective, you know, and I kind of look at it from a corporate perspective. And I'm trying to get my arms around this because I'm starting to think, well, we got these states, and so the corporations are going to kind of move around as we change the laws to how, you know, they're going to always go to where they're going to make the most profit, and they're going to move around. Have you looked into that? How a corporation, or I mean, it gets really complicated, I can see.
Yeah, economists, we refer to that as profit maximizing behavior, and that's what businesses and corporations do. There's always a short term and the long term. So corporations could be set up to structure their under cost of performance. They could set up their structure to minimize their tax. They will likely do that, and they can allocate, if you will, their cost of production to those states. And so as states change, they'll respond to those. Now, the ability of corporations to respond will actually depend on each individual corporation. It depends on their size and a lot of other things as well. It'll be access to markets, access to quality labor force. All of these things come into play as to where corporations and all businesses decide to conduct their business. And that's one of the things that after the fact makes it difficult to say, okay, state X was cost of performance up until 2000 and they went to market-based. So they've been in market-based for 15 years. That's a nice long time series of information, but so many other things change that it's hard to pin it down to just one exact policy.
See, like when I look at the history of my corporation, if I had to do it all over again, since I deal in Idaho, Washington, California, and Oregon mostly, my corporate headquarters would be Nevada. If I had to do it over again. But since I'm at the end of my working career, I'm not redoing anything. But if I had to do it all over again 30 years ago, well, it would be in Nevada.
Let's all talk about what we would do over again in our life. Senator Volkers.
Mr. Chair, I'm struggling with this here. There are 14 Finnegan states and 16 Joyce states. So I guess, you know, there must have been two divorces out here that didn't work out real well, okay? But the governor sponsored this bill and the Department of Revenue sponsored this bill. And all of the testimony, though I was very irritated with some of it, from the private sector was opposed to this. I'm still struggling here, and the revenue is indeterminate because there's winners and losers. So the question is why are we doing this again? I mean, who is going to be the new winner and who's going to be the old loser in this? I mean, there's some interesting rumors floating around about that. And once again, okay, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Who are the real proponents of this and why do they really want to do it? And what industries are going to gain? It's not, I love your deal, but it's not baseball bat companies, right? Okay. There's other companies that supposedly are going to be the winners, and then there's other people who are going to be the losers floating around there. So, Mr. Chair, I'm like, why Joyce or Finnegan? I mean, if it's ain't broke, why are we fixing it? And if we are fixing it, who's going to benefit since it's going to be indeterminate?
Well, the draft first, the response to the initial bill was the Joyce Finnegan, but that's getting pulled out. It's being replaced with the cost of performance in the market based. So the policy decision of Joyce Finnegan is being removed from the bill. And so it's the cost of performance and market-based. So it's in some, the Joyce Finnegan has to do with nexus for all of them, all corporations in a consolidated return one by one, or one, let me start over. You have a consolidated return with 10 affiliates in it. The Joyce method would mean to establish nexus, you have to go for each one of those 10 corporations. Whereas under the Finnegan, if one of them, one member of a unitary group has nexus, then they all have. So that policy decision is actually being taken out with the dash six. And it's being replaced instead with the debate between the cost of performance and the market-based sourcing for the intangibles and services.
And there has to be something here, because I'm looking at your revenue statement here. And there's going to be some winners, and there's going to be some losers. And then it's indeterminate. So all we're doing is shaking the juice up here and letting it separate back out.
Well, perhaps, Chris, you could talk about the software companies and why this was an issue for them.
This initially came up with the software companies and Measure 67, which was passed in 2009 and voted in 2010. Prior to that, the minimum tax was $10. So cost of performance wasn't really an issue because corporations were paying $10. But what happened with Measure 67 is there was, this has kind of become the prototypical example, a software company that operated in Oregon, and all of their sales, or virtually all of their sales, were in Idaho. And because of cost of performance, all of their sales were attributed to Oregon. Now, in a pre-Measure 67 world, it didn't really matter because it was a $10 minimum tax. But the company was large enough that their minimum tax may have been $100,000. So when we adopted Measure 67, this corporation went from a $10 tax, minimum tax, to a $100,000 minimum tax. And the market for their product was really, it was an entire export-oriented company. So all of their sales actually went to Idaho. So this would be an example of a company that the company would be a winner in that their tax would be reduced because the market-based would more align with where their actual economic activity or their output is.
So they're a winner. Now can you talk about Verizon in this scenario?
Well, we don't like to talk about.
Well,
I'm sorry, I have to throw that.
Yeah, no, I understand.
It up.
So, big cell phone company.
If we had a company that all of their cost of performance are, again, they're tangibles, and they all of their cost of performance is outside of the state, but they sell their product into Oregon, under cost of performance, they're paying very little, if no tax, probably just the minimum tax. But under market-based, their tax liability would go way up because Oregon is a sizable market for this hypothetical company.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
So, okay. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. It just seems that there's, it seems that we would only benefit from moving to a market-based, even though you don't have, supposedly it's indeterminate. I'm not sure what the criteria is exactly that you use in your office to say, but I imagine that the bars pretty high before you make a determination, right? I mean, you're not going to go out and make a statement unless you know it, unless you have pretty strong evidence. But because so many things are headquartered, so many companies are not headquartered in Oregon, but yet they're conducting business here, it seems that Oregon would most likely benefit from it if I were to guess. But I don't want to put you on the spot, but it.
No, I think that's a fair characterization. We've had a lot of conversations in our office about this, and mm-hmm. that's likely the case. Okay. But to come up with some sort of numbers, so mm-hmm. walking through that that mental exercise, if you will, okay, it's probably going to, let's say it is in all likelihood going to raise some revenue. Is it $100,000, a million, or $10 million? And well, then where do you put that number? And is there anything to base an estimate on? Because the way I've described it here is companies are one or the other. And the reality is that most companies are probably a mix because it depends on the sales that they make. It's actually done on an individual contract or sales basis. So I've oversimplified it by saying a company is intangible or not. Mm-hmm. So we try as best we can not to issue indeterminates because our task is to provide you with as much information as we can. But when I can't come down and with any basis to say, yes, it's this, it's $1 million a year, and this is why I believe it's $1 million a year, or $10 million a year, and this is why I believe it's $10 million a year. At least at this point, I'm stuck with an indeterminate. Mm-hmm. But I think you're capturing it kind of right. It seems like we would fit, and I tried to paint that a little bit in the
Chair.
Senator Brooks.
Here's my observation, and my position hasn't changed at all here. It is indeterminate of why we're doing this to me. And this is my point. Unless something changed from 8:25 when I last looked at all this and I walked down here, thank you, I asked my computer actually worked this morning. Every single business that's on there is in opposition. As you know, one of them I'm not very keen about, but that's okay. And I haven't heard a single business knocking on my door, entering into testimony saying, we're an Oregon baseball company, as in your original scenario, or a software company, and we need to do this. I haven't heard anybody say they support this thing. And if that's the goal, is we're trying to save, there's noble goals, we're trying to save X series of businesses out there and help them grow in Oregon, then I'd certainly like to see it in some testimony and hear it. I mean, I'm at a loss of why we're up here, because we're the five of us have to vote yes or no on this thing, and there isn't any support out there other than maybe the governor's office is still on board with this. I'm a little puzzled, and I'm, especially in this committee, when generally, as you know, they're knocking on our door like, I need this or I want that. I mean, silence is not golden in this particular time.
And if we were to go down this road of abandoning the corporate income tax and replacing it with a corporate activity tax, this issue goes away.
That's correct. This issue, at the end of the day, is an apportionment, how to apportion income.
God, I walked in there and ambushed it. Yeah.
It does go away.
One argument for that. Okay, we're in a work session here. We're not going to move this today. I don't know if there's anybody else here that's signed up. I don't think so. All right, so we will keep studying this, doing our homework. Thank you, Chris. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 28 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 123. We have a dash one amendment. Senator Riley, would you care to discuss the amendment?
Sure. It's a simple amendment. It takes the word education out of the bill because that's the job of school districts.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to SB 123, dated 3/2/17.
Senator Boquist moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 123. Discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 123 as amended with the dash one to the floor with a due pass as long as Senator Riley is carrying it.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 123 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Bertschiger?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no on this. Even though I don't have a tremendous amount of opposition, I think I need to flag it because I still have unanswered questions of how this will work with compression in these counties. And so I need to flag it by voting no. I'm not against children, and I'm not against special taxing districts. It's just I have unanswered questions. Yeah.
Okay. Further discussion?
I'll be happy to answer questions anytime you want.
And we may have that discussion.
Austin, could you do a roll call vote?
Yep. Senator Bexner.
No.
Senator Riley.
Yes.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yep.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes yes. Measure passed. Senate Bill 123 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate, and Senator Riley will carry the bill.
Thank you.
All right. Close that public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 564. This is Senator Girard's bill that needs, after it's been aired out here, to be moved to Ways and Means. Mazen, did you want to give us a 30-second refresher?
Sure. Chair Hass, members of the committee. This is the bill that Senator Girard brought in front of you, and this had to deal with the the ceiling of the bonding ceiling, if you will, and this takes the 5% that is usually recommended by the Debt Advisory Commission and put it, codify it in legal language and law in order to make that a very hard ceiling for the general fund bonding limitation. This does not, or actually it has a fiscal light because it's going to Ways and Means, so the fiscal impact is to be looked at Ways and Means, and I'm tempted almost to say the revenue is indeterminate, but no revenue impact.
It's not a good day to use that word.
Don't fall to temptation.
All right. So.
Okay. Any questions of Mazen?
Mr. Chair, I move SB 564 to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means under prior reference.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 564 with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, 564 goes to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Clears out our agenda today. Dr. Warner? Okay. We will adjourn until tomorrow at 8:30. Until tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you.